here? We're all here. So this is going to be the second portion of the Dennis Oppenheim program. And the puppet that you see here before you was the key performer in an installation that involved a mechanized, motor-driven marionette kind of apparatus that moved its arms and legs in rhythm to that soundtrack, which you've been listening to, which you may not have actually been able to pick up the lyrics to, but here they are. It ain't what you make, it's what makes you do it. And so this was a continuous loop with the puppet in continual motion, doing a very kind of interesting little dance, which Roger will try to demonstrate to you through some videotapes after I do this introduction. So this is Rosalie Goldberg's book on performance art, and I'm going to just read. I should walk a little bit here, but I'm going to read you some sentences from this which give a nice kind of setting to the piece and situate it not only in Dennis's oeuvre, but within the larger frame of body art, conceptual art, and so forth. I think I have to take my glasses off to do this. But, like many artists of the time, Dennis Oppenheim wished to counteract the overwhelming influence of minimalist sculpture. According to Oppenheim, body art became a calculated, malicious, and strategic ploy against the minimalist's preoccupation with the essence of the object. It was a means to focus on the objectifier, that is, the thing that makes the art, rather than the essence, rather than the object itself. So Oppenheim made several works in which the prime concern was the experience of sculptural forms and activities rather than their actual construction. And now I added a sentence here of my own. In these, he used his own body as material which would receive and be shaped and altered by actions performed upon it. Oppenheim believed that body art was limitless in its application. It was both a conductor of energy and experience and a didactic instrument for explaining the sensations that go into making artwork. Considered in this way, it also represented a refusal to sublimate creative energy into producing objects. By 1972, like many body artists involved in similar introspective and often physically dangerous explorations, he tired of live performance, just as Akanchi had done with his power fields. Oppenheim devised works which suggested performance, but which often used puppets rather than human performers. These little wooden figures, accompanied by recorded songs and phrases, continued to ask the fundamental questions raised by conceptual art. What were the roots of art? What were the motives for making art? And what lay behind seemingly autonomous artistic decisions? One example was Theme for a Major Hit, 1974. I think it's 74. It says 75 in here. But I think it was 1974, where in a dimly lit room, a lonely puppet jerked endlessly to its own theme song. So that's the end of the quote. I just have three main points about this. that I want to use as a kind of introduction. One is that Dennis called these puppets surrogates. The surrogate being a stand-in replacement for the artist. So in the quote from Rosalie Goldberg, you can see the movement from the use of the artist's body as the sort of substrate or material upon which various manipulations were being enacted to the use of a surrogate as a replacement for the body. That's one thing. It's not only an anonymous replacement for anybody, it's a self-portrait effigy of the artist himself. So there is Dennis in surrogate form enacting this performance, and it may have some relationship to the earlier piece where he didn't want to have to be there in case somebody might pull a gun and shoot him. But nevertheless, the puppets were all conceived as a surrogate performers for the artist himself. And so that's one thing. The second point that I had is that what is being represented in these kinds of works is the objectifier as opposed to the object. In other words, in line with what Tom said earlier about Dennis and that early coterie of conceptual artists reversing the direction of attention, let's say, from the object to the enactor or the creator of the object. And in Dennis's case, it was very often to the mind, to the psychic kind of dynamics that resulted in the work. Dennis was very interested in representing, that is, the process as opposed to the product of artistic practice. And I think that the surrogates that you see in the puppet works derived, on the one hand, in retrospect from the body art, and in future prospect to the machine works which he used, as also attempts to depict or represent the creative, let's say, the dynamics of the psyche that creates the work as opposed to the work. So they were, for example, machines that turned out objects like plants, manufacturing plants and various kinds of machine-like structures. So that's the second thing, to represent the maker as opposed to the made object. And the third has to do with the lyric. It's not what you make, it's what makes you do it. Could almost be a way of encapsulating one of the main tenets of conceptual art, which is that it's the idea or the motive or the intent that really is the art, that really is the art in the total picture of creative process. And the product then would be an inert residue of some kind, the resultant of that process, but not the art itself. The art was more inherent in the process of enactment, which is the psychological or subjective part. And Dennis, I think, devoted a great deal of his most creative sculptural effort to doing what I'm calling to make motive visible, to make the motive visible, to make the dynamic of creation visible, and that in itself to be the work. Tom said something like this also this morning, but and that's a really revolutionary idea, even within the context of modernism, I think, that the effort to depict the process being the work itself. So motive made visible. And that's about the lyric. And we can, you know, discuss what that lyric means to you and personally as we get further into the talk. But I want to now present Roger Welch, who was the drummer on the soundtrack. So has known Dennis, as I have, for a great long while. And since we haven't got this marionette working, Roger's found some amazingly entertaining clips from YouTube that he's going to use to show a very close facsimile of how this thing moved and what the sort of impression might have been on the original viewers of this piece. So, Roger, would you like to do that?
From about 68, I think, somewhere around that, 67, 68, several artists, including Chris Burden and many others, were prominently in the work. And when you saw something of theirs in a magazine, it was no longer a sculpture piece. It was themselves being a sculpture piece. And Vito Acconci, of course, and many others. And Dennis was also, I think there were several of us that got into this idea of doing works either outdoors in the land or inside where you would be a featured part of this process. And I think at a certain point, in about 73 or so, there was this movement away, or a little bit away from having the artist be the sole progenitor or whatever of the work. And Dennis, it was around that time that Dennis did this first puppet, and I remembered, Amy, you might know this, but I think he had sculptured by someone. I mean, it wasn't the cast of him that was reduced. It was done by somebody. I don't know, Bill, do you remember? I think it was, but anyway.
It was a carver who carved his likeness.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Right, somebody. So, he had a little sculpture made of himself, and that effectively removed, it was the beginning of removing yourself from being the thing that somebody would see. And after that, I can't think except for Vito Acconci, but many, many of the artists that were doing that tried to move away from this point of their being the kind of focus or performer. And anyway, what I was going to do and show you before we get into all that was there's a little history to the song. Now, when we first got together, when Dennis put a group of us together to do this song, we were given the song. I never actually knew anything about its history or anything. All I knew was that it was going to be about it's not what you make it, it's what makes you do it. So we knew it was about motivation. And there was a bit of improvisation going on. But I never knew until a little later that this actually had some history. And I'm fairly sure that Dennis was aware of some of the history of this song. Actually, Bill Beckley's over here was in the back there. He was on the soundtrack too. And I don't know, Bill, did Dennis ever say anything to you about where the song came from or anything like that? I don't think so, right? No. So anyway, now the first little clip here, there was a dance. Actually, this was a song, it's called It's Not What You Do, It's What Makes You Do It. And it was first recorded in the 30s. A guy named Jimmy Lunchford and Ella Fitzgerald sang. And there was a dance that was called the Shim Sham, and they danced the Shim Sham to this music. I decided to look up Shim Sham, or I looked up the word Shim and the word Sham. Well, Sham we knew was sort of a hoax or something that somebody does that's like a trick, but meant to deceive. But shim was a very interesting word because shim is actually a neutral gender. It's like the first part is she and him. And you take off a letter and you get shim. And that's what the origin of Shim Sham, I guess. And anyway, the music that we were playing was a dance music. And I'll show you a little bit of this, which is, okay. Now imagine the puppet doing this, though. So, of course, the puppet wasn't dancing this well. Now, when the puppet was on a little stage, a little platform, initially. It was a circular platform. It was a couple feet off the ground. And it was all by itself. He had later pieces where there were other puppets, but Swin was doing it all by himself. And there was a rhythm to it, like this. Actually, I found a lot of things on the internet about this. They have festivals where people still dance this all over the world. Well, this is almost over. I think Dennis liked that it was a catchy tune. But the next one that's coming up is my absolute favorite. The picture quality isn't great, but this is Little Richard. And you have to check out the background. So that was recorded in 60, that was from 1965, and I kind of felt if Dennis had heard something, that was probably more likely it. This was one other thing I'll show you, and this is an updated version that came out in the 80s, and this is Bananarama. Had any influence on this. They could have. I guess he kind of got the idea. there was a little, of course, there was about motivation. What was this little karaoke thing? I just threw this on at the end because it was a little bit like Lawrence Weiner and Bruce Nauman version. We're going to divide these seats up.
We're going to turn off this.
Yeah.
And
okay.
We're going to turn up the lights. We're going to turn
okay.
up the lights. And we are going to now...
Turn off the lights? Okay.
Ask you to pick up your chair and move it either over to this side of the room or over to that side of the room as you feel so inclined. According to if you have an affinity for what you make, being an artist, and I don't know what kind of artists you all are or performers, but nevertheless, what you make. What you do over here, and then on that side, we got the intentional crowd. What makes you do it? The motivated, the motivational idea, concept over there. So move yourselves around, and then we can talk about, you know, what's this all about. You're the sole survivor on the What You Make side?
I'm the make, yeah.
Oh, good. I want to hear you. I want to hear from you. Well, you know, Dennis probably should be in the middle. He was both a maker and a conceptualizer in one. But I'd like to, you know, we only have one. It ain't what you make, it's what you make. Are you coming over here? Yeah. Now, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, what do you make?
Oh, what do I actually make?
Are you an artist?
No, I'm not an artist.
What are you?
I guess I would say I'm a writer.
Oh, you're a writer.
So there's a process, and there's also a final product.
Right.
In general, not necessarily my attitude towards my own writing, but my attitude toward art in general. I think people now tend to fetishize the process over the product, mm-hmm. or the final object.
Can you all hear what he's saying? Yeah. Go ahead.
So, you know, because I think people fetishize the process so much in the way that people used to fetishize the object or what you make, I want to take the opposite point of view. I'm not interested in process. Let's explore the object again, mm-hmm. and figure out what makes it interesting. I mean, every artist has a process, and some choose to emphasize that. But there's usually an end result at some point, or a stopping point.
We'll
stop there and discuss.
Maybe I should try to make a finer discrimination between process and motive or intent. Because I agree with that. Absolutely, every artist has a process, and how they handle materials and what they go through in order to sort of get something started, and then, you know, follow their own way of putting the next thing down, whatever that is, whether it's a sentence or a stroke or a step, I don't know. But in the process of composition, there is every artist has that. But I'm not sure that this business of art, the intent behind art, is exactly coincidental with that idea of process. I mean,
The artist's intent is only part of what the work is about.
Right.
You know, you have the artist's point of view and you have the viewer's point of view. If a viewer comes in and sees a work of art, a painting, an installation, and doesn't know the intent of the artist, then he or she, you know, should be able to make sense of what that person's looking at.
Mm-hmm.
The artist's intent can be helpful in understanding the work of art. Can be very helpful, but it's not always essential, or it's just one of many ways of approaching an artwork.
Okay, thank you. So now I want to hear something from the other side about what you yourself understood about it. It's what makes you do it that made you side over there in the first place. I mean, what is it that means to you in terms of motive? Is it the same as process, or is it something else that, yeah, give them
I'm Robert Tompkins, and I went through a period where I was doing more kind of performance and monologues and images on the stage and so on in Southern California over about 15 years. And for me, it was more cultivating myself. It was more reaching some unknown potential of awareness and sensitivity and whatever else that meant, because I didn't really know. It was a trajectory from an earlier lifestyle. So So that's how I looked at it. And then whatever subjects interested me going through an investigative phase and through a kind of a randomness in terms of creating, you know, the creative process and so on. But ultimately, it was about myself evolving.
So that's a motive, which is not about process per se.
And that was a
motive. The motive is self-creation or self-study,
Right. The motive was to reach an unknown potential, and the only way one could do that was through actualizing yourself by creating something and then evolving somehow, not necessarily in a progression as the earlier lecture on history, not necessarily that, meaning a culmination, but it would, that's better.
Mm-hmm.
It would be wherever I evolved, how I cultivated myself through being influenced by the environment, the workshops I took, the mm-hmm. mentors I had, the community of artists I lived within, among, mm-hmm. and so on. So the motivation was, as I said, it was reaching some unknown potential.
I like that answer. Bill, do you think that that was Dennis's meaning when he said, it ain't what you make? Or do you think it had more to do with, let's say, an anti-commercial object attitude toward art in general?
Well, there was this whole thing at the time to not make objects.
Right.
Of course, in one way or the other, objects were being made. But there was this kind of claim that the object was and kind of evil thing or bad thing, and if you, the thing is that I don't think that Dennis really made a big deal of this particular kind of I mean, agenda. I think that he really thought it was cool to go out in a boat and to pour some kind of gasoline around the boat and light it. And And I think that he got off on that kind of thing and the kinds of things you've seen here.
Yeah.
But there was some people that made a big deal out of... It's kind of ironic because they said that they weren't making objects, but they were taking photographs of what they were doing and kind of disregarding the fact that a photograph is a kind of thin object.
Exactly. So they have... And then... You know, I happen to know that the dealers insisted that they do this in order that they had something they could peddle.
I'm actually not sure if it's the dealer's fault.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of experience with dealers, and they're weird in different kind of ways. But I first of all, you don't have to actually be with the dealer, you know, if you don't want to. And actually, the dealer that Dennis and I and that. And Roger were with John Gibson. I don't know if he's told us anything to do. You know, he liked the fact that there were remnants of pieces,
mm-hmm.
like, for instance, photographic.
They called it documentation.
Excuse me?
Documentation.
Yeah, and then he actually. He was fairly innovative in conceptual art, John Gibson, the dealer, and he took these photographs to Europe, where there was much more of an audience for them than there were here, in a kind of portfolio and a white Citroen, and he would drive from Paris to Dusseldorf to Baden-Baden to Basel in this Citroen, and with this portfolio of these photographs. And that's how he and many of the artists made a living.
Right.
I mean,
I might have packed many of those portfolios when I was, in fact, director of the gallery. So I know what that was about. But really, I'm trying to get to this idea of it ain't what you make.
There was also this thing. I mean, obviously the time had something to do with other social things that were going on, including the war. And the women's movement, which was really emphasizing the objectification of women. So objectification seemed to be a bad or evil
thing. Yes, that's an interesting thought. Objectify. So we don't want anything inert and just objectified. We want to give... priority to the attitude and the intention and motivation, the psychological and subjective dimension of the thing, rather than the material aspect of the thing. But you know, on the other hand, Dennis was quite a good sculptor. And, you know, when I was talking before about making motive visible, I think that he had a sculptural imagination that enabled him to make these things expressive of certain kinds of zones of almost what you might call pre-object state, which were unique and original in the whole history of that period, which kind of didn't end run about it ain't what you make, because it wasn't resulting in an object, but it was still a sculpturally manifest assembly or some kind of installation or action or something that was formed by what you might call an artistic sculptural imagination. So it wasn't just idea art that we're really talking about here. So that's you know, so in a way, these two things, it ain't what you make, it's what makes you do it, are I think have to be understood in a matter of priority, but not mutual exclusion. That's, yeah, Roger.
I thought we should get back a little bit to the piece, you know, the puppet with the strings.
Yeah, there are political and cultural dimensions to this, which we haven't talked about.
Yeah, and actually, even though, he didn't make a big issue of this, as Bill said, I think, but however, in this work, I'm quite sure that it had to do a lot with the way the artist was treated or handled, or the way that he felt that you're sort of trying to be on the edge of things, and you're trying to kind of be a little anti-establishment, I suppose. And at the same time, if you're dealing with museums and you're dealing with collectors, particularly collectors, and dealers, that they're pulling a string, and I remember an incident in particular. We were in France at Saint-Tropez, and there was a collector there who also did print editions and so forth. And one night, they had dinner, and then afterwards they wanted different workers and so forth to perform, or they were performing, they were singing and they were doing all sorts of things. And at one point, this collector said to Dennis, you know, can you get up? And he just like turned around and said to me, we're leaving. You know, he did not want any part of that kind of idea that, you know, what the artist, and I'm sure that maybe the collectors didn't understand.
Performer, a kind of court jester.
Jester, sir. Yeah. And actually, you know, artists have been used that way. And when you think of late, you have a lot of artists that have gotten to the point where they're more collaborators. I mean, somebody like Jeff Koons is able to kind of pull strings as well. But, you know, at that time, I don't think the artists had that kind of power, nor did they look at the dealers as necessarily collaborators. It was more like, and I know Dennis often had an adversarial relationship with dealers, and he kind of, I just felt that he didn't think that they were ever really doing the job, that the artist was always doing the job, and the dealer was always kind of taking a little credit for it. And not to mention the fact that you were always, you know, being told to go there, told to do this, told to do that. So I'm sure that when you're talking about the puppet, and actually I remember too, I had a little picture, I don't know if you remember, this was the ad for The Godfather, remember? And they had, right, the puppet, and this came out in 72, and that piece was 74, so there was this idea, you know, there was this thing in the image of minds of people of actually it's more like a marionette than it is a puppet. It's a marionette, which is slightly different than a puppet, but you still have the idea of a puppeteer who's controlling things. And so he was dancing to a tune, which was, it's not what you make, it's what makes you do it.
Right.
So, you know, in other words, at the same time, this little puppet is dancing to a tune, which is questioning the motivation and the instincts and what the art object is completely. I mean, what it is. And,
exactly.
And the artist is, like before we were talking, is the artist an art object, or is the art object the artist, or which is which?
Well,
and
he
it kind
started
of goes back
with
and
the
forth.
Body works by making himself the object in a way.
Yeah, well, the very, very.
The material, let's say. Yeah. The material. And then the surrogate takes the place of the artist's own person. You see? So,
yeah, well, that's what we were saying,
so
that he.
So there's a withdrawal of the from the finished work of the artist's own body.
Right.
And then,
the fundamental thing when you think about it is, does the art object convey the motivations and all the things? Because theoretically it should. It should read, maybe not completely, but there would be things that you could find in it that will be clues to why the artist did it. And then if you can't, maybe there's a little less of a success in terms of the object. But I'm sure, and Amy would know, I think Dennis, at a certain point, was very interested in the objects and the way they looked and how they came out. You know, he wanted the objects to function. And so it wasn't like it was only about why he was doing it.
Exactly. And for by the same token, the drawings that he made, which were just sort of like meant to be sketches or plans for things that elsewhere, you know, were in fact in and of themselves beautifully rendered collages and drawings with a very distinctive color and touch.
Are you talking about the machine one?
No, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, he made those drawings and they were beautiful.
Yeah. I was actually shocked one time. He said to me, you know, I've made all these. Like, we were looking at about 100 drawings, and he said, I've made them all. And that was sort of slightly stunning to me.
Mm-hmm.
The material or how the thing looks, I don't know. There was one title of one piece I remember is When the Mind Grew Fingers, right? And it's like the mind making this work. And that was, I think, a fundamental part of what he was doing. It was always kind of like saying, where does the mind bring this from?
Yes.
Or exactly. Where does it come from?
Yeah, and what I was trying to say earlier is that the attempt to represent that process of generating the image was where he wanted to put his formal mind to work, not in the outcome of that process, but in the generating mechanics that give rise to that product, which is a kind of extraordinary thing to do.
Now, the other issue is about signature, and we talked about that once. Signature work, like You look at a Rothko, you know it's a Rothko. You don't even have to be told it's a Rothko. You just see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody like Dennis, there wasn't like a clear, like, this work is him. Although, if you knew enough of his work, you knew. But he sort of avoided, or tended to want to avoid, this signature style. And we would talk about somebody like Lawrence Weiner, who had the signature style, and others that would have a signature style, which had to do with the object. The object conveyed that this is the artist.
Well, that's because they confine themselves to a very narrow form of vocabulary.
Right. But
the dentist,
it makes it,
the dentist would pick up anything, and like
right.
dust, right?
But it does make it easier in terms of for collectors and dealers and so forth to say, oh, well, we've got these works. And even when you think, you know, even Warhol, there's a certain signature look to it. And I think Dennis tended to have not want to get in that particular trap. But at the same time, it made it more difficult to get into the big
markets. Nobody wants artists to change styles. Every artist who changes their style gets a lot of flack for it.
Well, that's what we're talking about. So we're talking about object and motivation. And if the motivation is, say, the object is to sell it, that you'd be better off not changing your style a lot.
Right.
And so that was something that I think he even recognized the fact that he wasn't going to have a big market in that sense. And he tended to sacrifice it. Although the public sculptures were fine, but the other works he did sacrifice, you know, that signature style. And so there was a dialogue about the object and the motivation and so forth and so on. Phil, do you agree?
Oh, we're almost done.
Oh, we're almost over.
Okay. Well, I thought we were having a discussion. we haven't heard from everybody, but please do feel free to contribute your thoughts. Let her speak first.
Well, I wonder if someone who could speak to the inverted church, and that was very much an object that had a very great effect as an object. So at one point that must have been part of his thinking, that the object had maybe a purpose or could have a voice that would be different than his other works. Can anybody speak to that?
Well, the inverted church. Does everybody know what this is? It's a public. You want to describe this thing, Amy? The inverted church. It's a very.
Device to root out evil. Right.
Device is a very interesting word.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, he thought it kind of had a basis that was kind of pop, a little bit. Not solidly an object, because it was supposed to do lots of things. Can be devices. He used to use that word a lot: device to do this, device to root out, device to undercover.
Right.
So it was about the thing actually functioning in
That's
a way.
Right. Yeah.
So it has a function in this case to go under the earth and root out evil. So it does again put the object in a little bit of a back seat type position, because it's speaking about the function of the object more than the object
itself.
So,
do you understand? She said the object, certainly the way Tom described the movement of his career, he ended with these large, very object-like public installations, sculptures, really. However, he wanted them to still have that element that Amy describes of being enabled, not just an image, but a thing that has an activity or an intent to achieve some kind of purpose behind it. I think that may be true of all the public sculptures, that they weren't just meant to be decorative, and even though they were very object-like. Mm-hmm. But they were certainly objects.
Device is a very good, interesting word.
Device to root out evil.
Right, it bridges object and motivation.
Yeah. And that, I think, is a constant theme in the work, really. It just moves in one, you know, sort of one pole or the other, but the intent is always there. And to a lesser or greater extent, there is also the physical realization of some formal structure or other that will embody or somehow represent that motive. Because you can't have just, you know, a motive. You've got to have some, you know, embodiment of it in something in order for there to be art. That was good. Who else? Did you have another comment here?
Oh, yeah, just about motivation. The gentleman in the back mentioned the time that Louis Hoffman went with Peter Hutchinson to Trinidad and Tobago and put the gasoline on the sea on fire. And you implied that, like, he enjoyed that, like he got a kick out of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important motivation. It's not very serious or intellectual. Like, this piece here definitely has some big ideas behind it. But it's also really, really funny. And, like, I'm sure Dennis, you know, when he first set it up and got it going, that he probably had a giant laugh over it. I mean, it's funny.
It is funny.
I once saw a room of, like, 10 of these going at it. It drowned out the song. It was the most ridiculous sight I had seen. It was so noisy. Like, these things were just banging against the concrete floor. Like, there's a certain amount of, like, a motivation is just, to do something fun. And it's not something you can intellectualize. And
sometimes you shouldn't. And Dennis was, I think he got a great deal of just pure rapture. He liked blowing things up and setting them.
Like, oh, gosh, I've got to get this thing out. He didn't like to handle them. He knew they had to be dressed, they had to be presented, they had to be there. They had to be there. He felt a little bit like, you know, kind of like a little stupid doing it.
Like a slave.
He felt like he was, older man playing, you know, with a doll. He's got a doll here, so he didn't really like them. And also part of it that it was himself, that he was, this is his other alter ego.
His alter ego.
I think he somehow existed in each one of them to some extent.
Well, that was certainly the case. I mean, they are effigies.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful tribe in one of the islands off the coast of New Guinea, and when a chief dies, they take his head and they put it into this incredible sculpture thing with boar's tusks and all kinds of emblems of his achievements and all the heads that he took and all the things that he did, and they keep that in the men's house, and it's a permanent installation of a surrogate. And so we keep people somehow like mummies in Egypt. You know, we keep this as a relic, which is infused with the spirit and power and mana and personality of the person who it's represents. Yeah, but so are marionettes. That's why they're all in these science fiction movies, you know. Yeah. Ventriloquist puppets that come to life and start talking.
But I'm thinking of the difference between that and then, of course, the puppets that, what do you call them? When they're ventriloquists, when a ventriloquist is, you know, having these puppets. And that becomes even, like, a little more freaky, and there have been a lot of stories. I think Twilight Zone does a story about when a puppet actually kind of attacked
him. Chucky or some kind of.
Well, yeah, and Chucky, yeah. Actually, I'm sure that would have been scaring him.
But Dennis put his voice into the thing. It wasn't just that it looked, in the lecture piece. He was. It was his take.
Yeah.
his voice coming out of the puppet.
Well, that was just in the in that one work, though. That was just
in the lecture.
Lecture.
The table piece.
Oh, and the table piece.
With the, with the black and white.
Oh, was he?
He built the mechanisms back in 72.
Gary was here.
Gary
Perkins was here.
Perkins, yeah.
Oh. Oh.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. So there's kind of that eerie quality to it.
Yes, and there is an eerie quality to all these marionette pieces for those reasons.
And, but you can imagine seeing, as the installations grew, imagine seeing 23 small effigies of yourself in a room if you walked into it, how that would,
Well, there's a word for that. It's uncanny.
Yeah.
It's sort of creepy and uncanny and supernatural to see that.
I remember that fireworks and things like that gave him a lot of pleasure. If he could shoot off some fireworks from the roof or something,
yeah,
got a kick out of that. I don't know whether that was something that, if you were going into the situation of making an object, and one time he used tried to put fireworks in those sculptures, but it kind of backfired literally. But I think that the objects are, he didn't like just do something to watch it burn and thought that was cool. I think there was a lot more, he gave a lot more thought to most of the stuff.
He gave a lot of thought to everything. Powers that be have decided that we're almost done. We're going to end up by raising the volume on the soundtrack. And if you'd like to sing along with that,
That
you know the lyrics, you're welcome to do that.
Okay, class, we're going to raise the volume on the song and everyone's going to sing along with the lyrics.
What is it, Jim? What did he say? What? He said, it ain't what you play. It's what chords play it is.
Bye.
What you doing? What makes you do it? Okay, the next class, you have a brief recess. You can go outside, no smoking in the bathrooms, and we will be back at 4:20, correct?